Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 10 of Leadership Trademark Podcast. In today's episode, we'll be focusing on how do leaders communicate effectively. For that reason, we have invited Kevin Quinn and Michael Goldman. They'll be sharing with us tools and techniques to enhance your communications as a leader. Welcome, everyone, to episode 10 of Leadership Trademarked. This is the second episode on the engagement series that we started the last episode, and we have welcomed back Michael and Kevin. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Wonderful to have you back. And I am co-hosting today with Rosie, and we're going to basically talk more about how do leaders communicate effectively. So as leaders, we listen, we tell, and we provide a feedback loop. And so we most often in any conversation involve all three. And whether we're in a meeting, whether we have a one-on-one with our staff, whether we chair a town hall with staff, we use those three different types of communication types. And so today, I want us to have a conversation about that and how does that actually happen. So, Michael, you run lots of sessions, you run an organization. And so when you run a session, when you're contracted or you just run a session with your staff, how do you know that the participants are engaged? Whether you do that virtual or in person, how do you know that?
Yeah. So, you know, for virtual, hybrid, there's some really simple, easy ones. Like, you know, for example, and this is really difficult for a lot of leaders and tends to be one of their major complaints. That is, the video is on. So we actually see faces. I get those verbal and nonverbal cues. The use of those reaction icons, love it. The thumbs up, thumbs down, big kisses, whatever, in terms of how we're going, really gives that nice feedback in a nonverbal way. People willingly actually raising their hands visually, virtual or hybrid, or using the raise hand function. That's really good. Also, you know, as in person, people shaking their heads, you know, giving those kinds of encouragers, and also the amount of responses we get on chat. That's really also another important indication virtually in terms of people's engagement. In person, it's a lot of the same things, obviously not the digital technical things that we get, but you know, when we're in a room, you really get that sense of people being engaged. They're leaning towards each other. No devices are on. People are willingly raising their hands to volunteer ideas. And you get those moments of real deep quiet where you really sense that everyone is acutely listening to the person who's talking. And also another really key for engagement is people asking lots of clarifying or probing questions. And that really gets me a sense that they're trying to get involved or trying to get clear on what's being discussed.
Okay, Mike, so that's terrific. That's all the nonverbals and the verbals and the come on, let's go verbals with all kinds of ways to see whether it works. But I have another question. So what specific action would you take to actually make sure that that engagement, which you've called for and is being demonstrated or you think it is actually engaged?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And I think you have to look at it in terms of where we are in the sequence of a particular engagement. For example, there's before the engagement, there's at the start of the engagement, there's during the engagement, and there's at the closing of the engagement. So I want to really just quickly talk about each of those different timelines throughout the sequence of an actual event. So before the actual meeting, workshop, whatever, I think really great engagement is harnessed by sending out a detailed agenda at least 3 business days before. And in this particular agenda, we're not only just putting the topics, but we're identifying the results, who's going to be leading it, and any type of pre-reading or pre-work they have to done. For example, in our agendas, we actually put in the facilitated questions that we're going to be asking during the actual event. So those people who need extra time to kind of think about, what am I going to say? I don't really want to be put on the spot. That gives them a chance to prep. So we do that kind of thing. Certainly scoping. In our scoping, we really want to know who, what, where, why, and when we're trying to figure out the event and what goes into the event. We also want to understand, are there any possible resistance or personal biases that people might be bringing to the table? I also want to know if they're new to collaboration, because some folks have never really collaborated. They've just been told what to do. So that also, all these things inform the design. So, and of course, are people coming because they want to be there, or have they been voluntold? So that really impacts what we do before the meeting in order to ensure there's good engagement.
So Mike, as you're describing all that, I can see you've answered the question. So just to go down the rabbit hole a bit, I'm sure there are times when you need more or less of that. Do you build that into your timeline agenda so that you can actually say, as a facilitator, this is, you know, a major step before we get into what we're doing? Or do you just see what happens?
Well, I mean, we always make sure that we build a highly interactive and engaging process before walking into the room. But, you know, stuff happens.
Yeah.
And that's how come, you know, at the start of a meeting, we want to make sure we clarify the purpose and the outcomes, but not only clarify it, but ratify it with a group. Meaning we turn to the group and say, is this why you believe we're here? And is this what you're hoping to achieve? And at that particular point, now, certainly hopefully I've had time to do my due diligence before, and I'm really clear about it. But there have been times when, you know, one or two people are going like, no, that's not why I thought I was there. So, you know, then hence becomes a negotiation of what do we actually need? And then also taking the client to the side and just making sure it's okay with the client, because obviously they hired me to be there at the session to do what they thought was important. But again, if I did good due diligence, I've scoped out with beyond the client. I've actually scoped with those members attending what they need, you know.
Let me put you on the spot, Mike. You've just said, here's our purpose and outcome. And I speak up, and I'm pretty influential in this group. I've been around a long time. And I'm just saying, this is a waste of time. And we're spending all this money on this external facilitator. I can't believe this is going on again. It just won't matter. What does Mike do?
So what Mike says is, he says something like, so I'm hearing from Kevin that he believes this is a waste of time. The first thing I'm going to say to Kevin is, Kevin, tell me a little more. What do you mean this is a waste of time?
We've had guys like you come in before, and we never really seem to do anything about these decisions we make. I mean, nothing against you personally.
So your interest, I'm hearing, is that a decision is made today, or that there's follow-through on a decision. Is that it?
Really both. And that's really nothing. That doesn't happen very often around here.
Okay, so what I'm hearing then is, so I'm going to be paraphrasing, I'm going to be reiterating what that person says, I'm going to be checking it, and most importantly, I'm going to turn to the rest of the folks, and I'm going to say, here's what I'm hearing, what Kevin says, how do the rest of you feel? And if there is a consensus from the rest of the group that, you know what, Kevin's right, then I literally have to throw my design out the window. And we gotta regroup, and we gotta talk about what are the real outcomes. Now again,
okay. So Mike, at that point, and I've been there, I get that, you know, start over or dance on your toes. My question is, do you know, I mean, to the best of your ability with a group, okay? If the participants that are there know that they are accountable and they are responsible, and do you understand what authority they have?
Well, of course, I would not. I mean, let's put it this way. Through very hard knocks, I've learned the importance of ensuring I know what their authority is
okay.
before walking in, because to walk in and assume they have a higher decision-making authority than they actually do can actually set everyone up for failure.
Yep.
So I absolutely, that is one of my key scoping questions when determining decision-making and what decision-making looks like. Because that, the level of empowerment, and we've talked about this before in a previous podcast, is that the level of empowerment of the folks actually so important because it informs the decision-making design.
Yeah.
Right? So a low level of empowerment will mean that I might just be facilitating feedback with a group, asking, yeah. what do you like about it? What are you? But if they actually have a higher level of empowerment,
yeah.
that demands an actual decision-making process.
Right. Okay. And in my experience of doing facilitations and working with groups, I've always found that it was important to do exactly what you're saying. And that sometimes, no matter what, I couldn't really ratify that these people actually knew that it was their job or their accountability. Or they did know that, but in fact, nobody had ever actually said to them, you have the permission to take this and go with it. And of course, in terms of a team group or an idea or a new process or whatever, the skills they need to do that, they probably don't have. That's why you guys are there. But if they don't know that they have the power or the permission or that they're going to be held responsible and accountable for getting it done, then the value of the work we're doing, the tools we're giving them, the conversations we have, it just becomes talk. It's not action. And I can remember when I saw from an opening where everybody's involved to getting down to it, I could just like feel the energy fall out of the room. Yeah.
In that particular circumstance, was there an assumption that people did know and therefore you were there to facilitate them through exploring it and understanding
yes.
it more?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Right. Yes. And so the only thing that I could do at that time was turn the question upside down and say, well, if you were accountable and if you were responsible and if you had the authority, what would you do? And then, of course, all kinds of genius came out. And then, well, you know, you have to kind of wiggle and weave it in. But I've always found in meetings I've attended and projects I've led or been part of that somehow, Mike, there's an assumption that people who are on the project team do get it.
Right.
And yeah. I've found out 90% of the time that they don't get it. Yet that they'll be punished if they don't do it. Yeah. But they're not so clear about what it is.
Right, right, right.
So I would always rather find that out as early as possible in the gig.
Mike, that's pretty clear. So you have to spend a sufficient time, not a lot of time, but just enough time to clarify certain key things at the beginning, and that helps with engagement. What about in the actual session?
Yeah, so during the session, we use, like, particularly in virtual meetings, we use what's called a participation map, and that's where everyone's name is just mapped out, and every time someone initially says something, we put a little check mark. So I actually kind of gauge how much people are participating and to what extent, and I let people know I have a participation map. And I say to them right up front, hey, if I haven't heard from you, I'm going to call on you at some point because I want to ensure this is an inclusive conversation. So that really helps. Most of the time, I don't need it because now people know I'm going to call on them. So that really helps. Breakouts, you know, breakouts either in the room or breakouts, you know, in terms of a digital breakout. That's really helpful. always starting with a round robin, you know, so that's really easy to do because you, most of the time we see everyone's name on the participant list when it's remote, but in person, you can just go around the room using things like what I call 1-2-4, where you ask the question, you get people to individually fill out their ideas. That's one. And then you get them to pair up with someone else and share their ideas. That's two. And get them to, like, if you say, hey, come up with two ideas individually, when you pair them up, you can say, you know, with your four ideas, pick the two best ones. And then four is where you bring two pairs together. So through this process, you're not only expanding ideas, but you begin to synthesize or filter ideas down to the best before you then open it up to a group plenary. People have already done that themselves. Using things like creative brainstorming techniques, using chat or what we call chat storms, where you ask a question and you get everyone to put in their answer, but you don't say press return until you've given them about a minute, and then all these ideas jump out. You know, so that's fun. Polling, use of emoticons, use of a digital timer, or even in the classroom, using a digital timer up on a PowerPoint to create that sense of urgency and getting people to talk. And of course, using other folks to, if you have hybrids, meetings, to have someone actually dedicated to watching people online. We call that a remote advocate. Or if you're virtual, having someone being the chat monitor, because sometimes we get so carried away as a facilitator, we miss out those important cues. Yeah.
What about if somebody has an idea that's just totally off track, but you don't want to really shut them down?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, if someone has something that's off track, I'll hear them a little. And again, depending upon the time, how much time we left, I might just, you know, say time out. I'm wondering if we can park this just because in lieu of time, we need to hear from a few other people. I might ask them, hey, I'm just, you know, I'm a little lost here. I'm wondering if you could just help me understand how this is on point or how this relates back to our purpose. I might do something like that. So, but I never, you know, what's really important about intervening during an actual discussion is ensuring you never shut down someone or you do that ouch experience. You never want to put someone down. You always want to make it's all any intervention you should do should always be geared to re-engaging them and to making sure that they're part of the group. And finally, at closing, what engages people is making sure you have a clear action plan structure. So you're actually asking things like, okay, what's the action? When will it be done? Who will be doing it? What kind of prerequisite support you need? Is it a budget? Is it resources? Is it other people? And then what's the result? And then getting feedback on the meeting. So you're constantly improving the meeting. That's it. Yeah. So really important. Yeah.
No, I just wanted to jump in because we have been talking a lot today around facilitating groups, large groups, you being contracted. But Michael, if you can put your hat of, you know, the leader of an organization, you probably have day-to-day meetings that, you know, you're, you know, planning all these meetings, you're in and out. Myself, I'm in meetings probably more than 75% of the time. And to set up, you know, this, you know, the purpose is very, it's critical. But my question is specific to on a day-to-day basis. So forgetting the facilitation first, now you're the leader, you're, you know, and Kevin could testify here because he's a witness. And so how do you do that? How do you do that? Do you set something in advance? Do you, you know, write everything out? Is it, how much time do you spend? Because that's, I think, one of the biggest issues that at least I face is the time to plan.
Yeah. I mean, I have developed so much process expertise over the years that I'm really quick, but I have a lot of compassion for newbies in this area who understand there is a diligence, there is process, there is structure that is required to run an effective meeting. So, you know, particularly in our workshops, when we train folks, we give them lots of templates. And in those templates, we usually add a lot of, let's say, how do you open a meeting effectively? You know, so state the purpose, state the outcomes, state the norms, you know, seek permission. We have that all written down. And so having templates where you have what would normally be 90% what you would use to open up and close is very helpful. And so that expedites time, right? But certainly outcomes, you know, what I always suggest to intact groups when we go in and train them is to create a repository, create a central repository that once you do a meeting and you put it together, put it in that repository so everyone else has access to it. So we get all of these brilliant ideas and templates coming together, and we actually develop some kind of taxonomy where it says, you know, team-based, or it is decision-making based, and we actually put it in so people have access to it and they know where to look. And so that also would help expedite creating a process that would be relevant to any kind of meeting. And honestly, there are only really so many processes you need. I mean, a good decision-making process can work in most circumstances. A good problem-solving process, you know, could. Kevin, I think Kevin has something to say.
Sylvia, I'm going to answer the question less brilliantly than my colleague and just say, if we're talking a simple meeting, maybe a one-on-one with a staff member, go beyond just saying one-on-one in the calendar. Say, my purpose, one-on-one is maybe the title of the meeting, but purpose. Do a check-in, especially about that niggling problem you mentioned last week. Outcome, resources to you, or a redefinition of the scope of that project. Just that much. Takes about 2 minutes. I've been measuring this with new facilitators and trying to get them to do it, and new leaders. And it takes about 2 minutes, not the first time. First time it takes 10 minutes to just put 20 words, but then eventually you get to do it in 2 minutes. You have to develop this discipline. You've just queued up your meeting in your calendar. You're going to click send. It's got the person that you're sending it to, and you realize there's no purpose and outcome. So you go down to the description, purpose, colon, this, outcome, colon, and that will create, I guarantee that'll create twice as effective a meeting than if you just said one-on-one, where the person's thinking, doesn't think ahead about what you want to talk about, might not have the resource to hand in the meeting because they have to go through their files to find it, where it's just a little bit of purpose and outcome clarity, specificity, helps your resources to be smart. And they are smart. You hired them because they're smart, but they're not smart in the moment because they're not prepared.
Right. So, Kevin, to take that to the question of engagements, then what does that approach do for their capacity or desire or attempt or personality structure to become more engaged?
Yeah, well, just think about how, just mechanically, if you don't know what you're going to be talking about, you're kind of vaguely engaged in your mind that I have a future meeting versus Sylvia wants to talk to me about project updates and the particular bottleneck, and I better get this report. I got to talk to somebody else before I go to the meeting because I want to know from them. All those things, you're suddenly more engaged because there's a chance for you to be more than just reactive in the meeting. You're going to be proactive. That'll make you look good, Sylvia. And she rewards high performance, so it's a real win-win from everybody. So it goes from this engagement to the extent that you said yes to a meeting, which is a very low level of engagement, to I'm engaged in preparing for the meeting and getting ready. And if I'm an introvert, that's going to be a real help. 50% of the population, they need to think ahead. And they won't be, they're caught flat-footed. It's like, oh, they're not very impressive, but they're so impressive when they've had prep time. Thanks.
That's really cool. No, that's really, really cool. So I really like some of the key things that you have both mentioned. And now, Kevin, if I stay with you for a minute, because now we're in the meeting, okay? We've sent the purpose and the outcome in advance, and now we're in the meeting. What can you tell us about the credible and approachable voice in how we communicate?
Sylvia, are you referring to these cool names for the two ways that we can talk? And let me back up a little bit. In a meeting, you defined this earlier, that there's certain things you can do. You can tell things, you can ask things, and you can kind of feedback, give a feedback loop. When we tell things, you may have read this, that if there's a misalignment, if you're telling in a way that doesn't sound very convincing, it doesn't sound like you know what you're talking about, then people will wonder, well, is that really true? Or so there can be interference. So here's the deal, and it's so simple when you hear it. That is that when you have something to say and you are the authority in it, let's say you're at the beginning of a meeting and you're giving some guardrails or limits or constraints on what we have to do, our decision can only be made if it's low cost or if it corresponds to some regulatory issues, then you send that information, you tell that information by going down at the end of your sentences, like I just did. That sounds credible, and that's the word we use to describe that voice pattern. The other pattern is the one where it kind of goes up and down and up at the end when it sounds like you're asking a question. You do that not when you're sending information, but when you're inquiring, obviously, because it sounds like a question, but you're also asking for help, asking for input, saying you are the empowered ones here. I want to hear from you. And because here's a case of alignment. This has to be a zero cost decision. I've gone down at the end, zero cost decision. But what if I went up at the end? This has to be a zero cost decision. Oh, Kevin's not really sure about that. You see the way your subconscious mind starts to say, what's up with that? Or, oh, he's being put under pressure to say that, but he doesn't want to. Or you get all kinds of imaginings. So align your voice with your message. If your message is to tell information that is true and you're an authority, do it with your voice going down at the end. Repeat after me, everybody. Credible voice goes down at the end. Okay, ready? Credible voice goes down at the end. Very nice. An approachable voice. Let's say I've given all that information, and I want to shift over to asking, to wondering, to enlisting their support and their assistance. I'm going to shift that voice, and sometimes that's hard for leaders to do, because if you're good at the credible, sometimes you can't change gears. So you might say, are there any questions? Well, that went down at the end. Sounds like, and I don't want to hear any questions. So you've got to say, and are there any questions? That's going up at the end. It's a little more sing-song, and it goes up at the end. So let's do that one. Approachable voice goes up at the end. Approachable voice goes up at the end. And some leaders, they don't want to do that, because that just sounds, I don't know, somehow wrong. But it turns out that when we align our voice and say what we're saying and telling and sending with down at the end, and when we're asking or enlisting support or saying, hey, this is your job. Roz earlier mentioned how sometimes people are unclear that it's really their job to do it. This is one of the ways you're actually lowering the sound of your sort of bigness, and you're taking yourself down a little bit, sounding like, I don't know, you'll have to help me. How can we do this? You know, you go up at the end like that. And that's the difference between communicators who are really aligned and sending clear messages, either that I'm telling you this, or I'm really wondering and I need your help, versus communicators who get all mixed up and then people are confused.
So I said I wasn't going to do this, but I'm going to do it. So I learned that approachable voice is the voice that children use. Can I have more allowance? Can I have the car keys?
Or even statements like, we went to the park with Donnie
and
Cedric, and we really had a good time. Well, those are actually statements, but the kids saying them, is that okay? Do you accept me? Am I all right?
But the point is that when a leader uses approachable voice, in spite of the fact that they may think that they're King Kong, they lose all credibility. And generally speaking, not always and not everybody, but generally speaking, poof, all the engagement and commitment just washes out of the group. Now, trying to pull that back as a leader, if you were the one that did the approachable voice, your credibility is already down the drain. So all you're going to look like then is Mr. Command and Control. So now you've got a bigger mess on your hands, because you've gone from I was credible, or maybe he's not credible, into do what you're told, which means I don't trust you, you leader. And now you've cratered it.
There's actually research around this as well. I think you probably have heard some numbers around how much body language matters, and that's all, that research is often misquoted. Here's what the research showed, and that is when there was a mismatch between the words you're saying and the vocal tone or the body language you're using. So if you say this has to be a zero cost decision and you go up at the end, that's a mismatch. And it turns out that like 90% of the people in the room will think he's not telling me the truth because there's a mismatch, and they'll believe the vocal tone or body language almost all the time. And the words just, they don't mean anything because there's this mismatch. So that this is how important it is for leaders when they're telling to use credible voice, and when they're asking and enlisting support, it's to kind of have that sing song and go up at the end so that people are clear that they really want help. And then it sounds weird when I do it, help, but that's the way to do it.
That's wonderful. Thank you, Kevin. I really appreciate it. Thank you both for joining us again on this episode. Episode 10. There's a lot of learnings here. I appreciate you coming and joining us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Sylvia and Roz.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to episode 10. I hope you have enjoyed the wonderful tools and tips to enhance your communication skills as a leader. Regarding our future episodes, we will be reconvening in the fall. So stand by for new and exciting series of our podcasts. Until then, our current series will continue to be available, and you can revisit the content, and please share it with your colleagues and within your network. Thank you, and see you soon.